will make time to read the scholarly article by Donald Livingston that I put on the syllabus, because it really is just packed with information about this whole topic of secession. And I think, of course, secession is just another word for a freedom of choice, freedom of association, if you think about it that way. And I think to look at it from a historical perspective, I think the first thing we have to understand is that, well, of course, this is mostly associated with the American Civil War, as it's called, the whole idea of secession. But of course, the American Revolution was a war of secession. It wasn't really a revolution. It was a war of secession. There was no attempt to take over the government in London, for example, which is what a revolution would do. The American colonists wanted to secede from the British Empire. And so it is not at all an exaggeration to say that the United States was created by a war of secession from the British Empire, and that the very principle of the American Revolution, as it is called, is secession, freedom of association. And when the colonists decided that they were living under a tyranny, they decided they had a right to leave that tyranny. And so it would be unthinkable, I think, to believe that the same people who fought a bloody revolution in the context of a war of secession would then turn around and create a government with so much centralized power, just like a king, from which there could never be any escape. It just makes no sense at all that they would do that. And of course, they did not do that. The Articles of Confederation, the first Constitution, was called the Articles of Confederation and Perpetual Union. That was the formal name of it. And of course, the Americans at that time seceded from that. They dumped the Articles of Confederation and Perpetual Union, and the words Perpetual Union appear nowhere in the U.S. Constitution. It just says a more perfect union, a better union, not perpetual. And it also, when the Revolutionary War ended, when the King of England signed a peace treaty, he signed it with each individual state. The actual treaty reads, it names by state, Virginia, Rhode Island, Massachusetts, and so forth by name, because the states at the time were considered to be free and independent states, just like Holland or France or Spain was a free and independent state. And so when the King of England made a peace treaty, he didn't make a peace treaty with something called the United States government or the government in Washington. He made a treaty with 13 different governments, 13 different states. Each colony was considered to be a state on equal footing as the Great Britain in terms of being a state. And as such, these states thought of themselves as sovereign over the central government that they created. And so they created, through the Constitution, a federal government, a central government that would have delegated powers delegated by them to serve them for their benefit. And Virginia, Rhode Island, and North Carolina are three states that specifically wrote into their ratification documents that they reserved the right to withdraw from the Union at any future date if the Union became abusive of their liberties. In their opinion, there was never any pretense that there had to be unanimous opinion or that they had to have the opinion of anybody else, because each state, after all, was considered to be sovereign. And also, under the U.S. Constitution, no one state has more powers than another. And so when these three states declared that they had these powers, the power to withdraw from the Union as a voluntary union at any point in the future, it was naturally assumed that all the states had the same powers. And they were accepted into the Union under that understanding by everyone. And if you ever read the Article 7 of the United States Constitution, it explains how the Constitution was to be ratified. It was to be ratified by state political conventions, and where each state sent representatives from different communities to vote up or down on joining or not joining the Union. And it would become law when 9 of the 13 colonies ratified. It would become the law for those 9, but not for the other 4. And of course, several states, Rhode Island and New York and North Carolina, stayed out of the Union for a while after it was ratified, but they eventually came into the Union. And there was no talk by anybody of sending an army to Rhode Island to bomb Providence into a smoldering ruin or anything like that for not being in the Union. Because the Union was a voluntary union, and that's always what how it was thought of by the founding generation. And if you read some of the readings that I put on the reading list, there are quotes from Madison in there and others as saying this very, very explicitly about the nature of the voluntary union of the state. That's why the phrase United States is always in the plural in all the founding documents. In the Declaration of Independence, in the Articles of Confederation, in the Constitution, the United States are, and it's always that way, because if the free and independent states are united in forming this compact among the states. And of course, one of the articles I put on the reading list was my article on the New England secession movement. And that's an interesting example of how as soon as Thomas Jefferson was elected president in the year 1800 and his party gained power, the New England Federalists began plotting to secede. And they had a number of grievances against a government which they thought was dominated by Virginia in particular. And one of the big grievances they had was with Jefferson and the Louisiana Purchase. And the New England Federalists were believers in ethnic homogeneity. They believed in ethnic purity. I quote one of them as claiming that New Englanders of that era were, quote, the choice offspring of the choicest people, unpolluted by foreign blood. And they saw the Louisiana Purchase as something that would invite Spaniards and Irishmen and Italians and all the riffraff of Europe into America that would spoil the ethnic purity that they so treasured in New England. And so they rioted over this. And the ministers, they didn't riot, but verbally rioted over this. And the ministers especially were harsh. They started comparing Jefferson himself to the devil. They called him Beelzebub. And they just defamed him in the worst way over this, over the Louisiana Purchase. But they also had many complaints that I call Calhounism, because they believed at the time, they suspected that the Virginians, who were controlling the government at the time, would use the government to plunder them with various economic policies. And so they didn't want to have anything to do with it, so they plotted to secede. And so that was the second reason. Then when Jefferson imposed the trade embargo, I talked about that last week, as a second best policy in response to the British kidnapping of American sailors and the impressment of American ships to be used for Britain's war with France at the time. Jefferson imposed the trade embargo because he thought that was economically, it was better than another war with England and all the blood and treasure that would be lost in another war with England. And so the New Englanders protested very vehemently the trade embargo, and that fueled their desire to secede and create their own country. And then came the War of 1812, and New England essentially did not participate. I have also mentioned this in one of the earlier lectures. They decided not to participate at all in the War of 1812. And they issued all sorts of declarations of nullification, and as I've already discussed in the class, and they just didn't participate at all. And so this all culminated in the Hartford Convention of 1814, where New Englanders, the New England Federalist Party, led by Timothy Pickering, held a secession convention. And Pickering was George Washington's adjutant general of the Revolutionary Army during the Revolution. He was Secretary of War and Secretary of State under George Washington. He was also a United States Senator from Massachusetts. And so this is not a wild man or some nut. This was a very prominent statesman from New England who led the charge. And if you read my article that's on the syllabus, you can read his own words as saying that secession or separation was the principle of the American Revolution. And so, of course, all states, the citizens of every state, have a right to secede from the Union when they believe that that Union becomes abusive of their constitutional liberties or which has broken the constitutional contract. And so they held the convention in Hartford, Connecticut, and they issued several proclamations. They voted against secession. They decided not to secede. There was very little talk about whether or not there was a right to secede. Everyone, just about everyone, assumed that this was a right that they had. Even John Quincy Adams, as is quoted by Donald Livingston in the article I put on the reading list for tonight. And so, but they were career politicians, and they were worried that they would not have very long careers in politics if they seceded. And so self-interest sort of prevailed, as it always does in politics. But they were very serious, about 10 years in plotting to secede. And of course, all during this time, when Jefferson was being asked about this, you know, what do you think of this? His friend said, these New Englanders plotting to secede from the Union. And here's one of the things Jefferson said. He said this in an 1804 letter, January 29th, 1804, letter to a Dr. Joseph Priestley, who asked him about the New England secession movement. He said, whether we remain in one confederacy or form into Atlantic and Mississippi confederacies, I believe not very important to the happiness of either part. Those of the Western Confederacy will be as much our children and descendants as those of the Eastern. And I feel myself as much identified with that country in future time as with this one. And I didn't, and did I now foresee a separation at some future day, yet I should feel the duty and the desire to promote the Western interest as zealously as the Eastern, and doing all the good for both portions of our future family, which would fall within my power. Okay, so, and he went on in another letter in 1803, he wrote to John Breckinridge, the senator from Kentucky, and he said, if there is a separation into two confederacies, God bless them both, and keep them in the Union if it be for their good, but separate them if it be better. He did not take the Lincolnian view of bombing and burning and waging total war on the civilian population of anybody who attempted to secede for the benefit of a glorious Union. The Union was, in Jefferson's eyes, a practical political arrangement primarily for foreign policy and national defense purposes. And if the citizens of a sovereign state decided it wasn't working out for them, then he said, God bless them, and I will support them. That was Jefferson's view of all of this. And so the New Englanders were the first to seriously discuss secession long before there was any talk by anybody in the South of seceding. And then after that, after this happened, there was a middle state secession movement. And I cite a book in my article on the reading list for tonight called The Secession Movement in the Middle States by William Wright, W-R-I-G-H-T. And the middle states were Pennsylvania, Maryland, Delaware, New York, and New Jersey. And William Wright surveyed the speeches by politicians and hundreds and hundreds of newspaper articles in these states in the 1850s. And he found that the majority of newspaper editorials in the 1850s in all of these states on this topic, on this question, favored the right of secession, certainly, and some of them favored joining the southern states in a separate confederacy. Some of them favored forming their own confederacy in the mid-Atlantic, but none of them favored being in a union with the New Englanders. These people all seemed to sort of detest New Englanders at the time and did not want them to be a part of their government. And then others simply said, if the South does secede, we should support letting them go in peace, because this is, after all, a voluntary union. And so there were two major secession movements in different regions of the country long before the Southerners seceded, which led up to the War of 1861-1865. And on top of that, there were a lot of abolitionists in New England who wanted to secede for reasons altogether different from what the New England Federalists of the early 19th century wanted to secede for. They wanted to secede because they did not want to be a part of a union of states that had so many slaves, even though there were still some slaves in New England. At the time, some of them were thought, some of the abolitionists were talking about that. And I suspect that some of the abolitionists, like William Lloyd Garrison, understood that if they did separate and created a New England Confederacy, that would have made rendered defunct the Fugitive Slave Law, the Fugitive Slave Act, which forced Northerners to run down runaway slaves. And if that happened, say a slave from Virginia escaped and made it into New England, he would no longer have a bounty on his head, a federal bounty. But the Fugitive Slave Act, which Abraham Lincoln himself very strongly supported, did that. It put a bounty on the head of runaway slaves. That's why the famous Underground Railroad ended up in Canada. If you were a runaway slave and you popped up anywhere in one of the northern states, you still had a federal bounty on your head and could be captured for the bounty and returned to your owner. And so I think some of these men were smart enough to understand that would have helped break the back of Southern slavery economically if they seceded and created a Northern Confederacy in that way. And some of them, if they didn't think it through that much, simply did not want to be part of the South, a union with a region that had 4 million slaves. And of course, at the time, the abolitionists, the Middle Atlantic states, and the New England Federalists did not question the right of secession because everyone assumed that the union was voluntary. And voluntary means you can join or not join. And another thing that I point out in my writing is that there's a big two-volume set of books that I own. It's called Northern Editorials on Secession, by Howard Cecil Perkins, edited by Howard Perkins. And it's hundreds and hundreds of newspaper articles in 1859, 1850, 1861 on the whole topic of secession. And Perkins argues that the majority of Northern newspaper editorials advocated peaceful secession because they still believed in the Jeffersonian dictum from the Declaration of Independence that governments derive their just powers from the consent of the governed, and whenever the people no longer consent, then the people have a duty to abolish that government. I'll read a few examples. November 10, 1860, the Albany, New York Atlas and Argus newspaper said, quote, "We sympathize with and justify the South because their rights have been invaded to the extreme limit possible within the forms of the Constitution." Concord, New Hampshire Democratic Standard newspaper on November 24, 1860, complained of fanatics and demagogues of the North who waged war on the institutions of the South and appealed for concession of the just rights of our Southern brethren, meaning just rights to secede. The New York Journal of Commerce, 2 days later, condemned what it called the meddlesome spirit of the people of the North who seek to regulate and control people in other communities. Bangor, Maine Daily Union on November 13, 1860 said this, quote, "The union depends for its continuance on the free consent and will of the sovereign people of each state, and when that consent and will is withdrawn on either part, their union is gone." And then it said that if military force is used to keep the union, then the state, quote, "can only be held as a subject province and can never be a co-equal member of the American Union." And so all throughout the northern states at the outset of the so-called Civil War, northern editorial writers voiced the opinion that the union was voluntary, and if it's held together at gunpoint, then it's a mockery and a farce. It's no longer a voluntary union, but it's a tyranny. It's more like the Soviet Union, in other words, than the American Union. I can go on. The Cincinnati Daily Press on November 21st, 1860 said this, "We believe that the right of any member of this Confederacy to dissolve its political relations with the others and assume an independent position is absolute. That, in other words, if South Carolina wants to go out of the Union, she has the right to do so, and no party or power may justly say her nay." And I quote many other newspapers from the North, these are all the Northern newspapers saying this at the outset of the war, And then, of course, Lincoln manipulated South Carolinians into firing on Fort Sumter, where no one was hurt, let alone killed. And of course, the South Carolinians were stupid enough to fire on Fort Sumter, and that gave Lincoln, in his mind, a rationale for waging total war on the civilian, entire civilian population of the southern states for 4 years, killing some 350,000 Southerners in the war. And that seemed to whip up war fever. It was enough to whip up war fever in the North, firing on Fort Sumter. And after Fort Sumter, Lincoln thanked his naval commander, Gustavus Fox, for helping him manipulate them into getting the preferred outcome, as Lincoln put it. And I quote all this in my book, The Real Lincoln, and give you chapter and verse of all of this. And so, if you look at the history of secession, Americans, up until the Civil War, the great majority of Americans believed the Union was voluntary, and that, of course, every state had a right to secede. But there had been an ongoing political battle over this. Almost as soon as the ink was dry on the Constitution, the Federalist faction, the Nationalists, began reinventing history and just inventing out of thin air the notion, the odd notion that the Union somehow created the states didn't create the Union of the states. That's kind of like saying a marital union can be older than either spouse, to say that the union of the states is older than either of the states. It's an impossibility, a logical impossibility. And Alexander Hamilton was probably the first one to make this this false argument. And it was carried forward, though, by Joseph Story, the famous Supreme Court justice, and Daniel Webster, who was in a famous debate with Robert Hayne, the senator from South Carolina, in the 1830s. And this became a part of sort of the fake history of America, that the states were never sovereign, that the Union somehow created the states. And that is unequivocally false. It never happened that way. The states ratified the Constitution in state political conventions. So history was rewritten, but hardly anyone was buying it until after the Civil War, when the government finally took complete, total control and nationalized the educational system. And in war, of course, the victors always write the history. So from that time on, Americans have been taught these false history of the American founding, the nationalist version, the New England version of the American founding, and the New England version of many other things as well. And so the real history has been almost lost. And as I said earlier, that's one of the reasons why I've offered this course, to give students an opportunity to at least begin understanding that there's an alternative literature out there that you can look at. And another thing that has been rewritten is the Declaration of Independence itself. And the Declaration of Independence, of course, was a declaration of secession from the British Empire. That's what it led to. It led to a war of secession from the British Empire. I mentioned last week, when I read the last paragraph of the Declaration of Independence, it called the states free and independent to do what? To raise taxes, to wage war, and do everything all other states do. But that was rewritten by Lincoln himself when he emphasized the one phrase in the Declaration of Independence about all men are created equal. And he argued that that the Declaration trumps the Constitution legally in a metaphysical sense, because this idea of all men are created equal is a superior moral or metaphysical idea, superior to the Constitution. And of course, Lincoln didn't mean all men are created equal in terms of equality of human beings. Lincoln has also stated during the Lincoln-Douglas debate, he said in his words, "I, as much as any man, want the superior position to belong to the white race." He opposed giving the rights to vote or the rights to be on juries to black people. Until his dying days, he advocated and was plotting to deport the freed slaves out of America. He was a member of the Illinois Colonization Society when he was in the state legislature in Illinois. He supported the Illinois Black Codes. He supported the Illinois Constitution, which prohibited black people from entering into the state. Abraham Lincoln was as much a white supremacist as any man of his time. If you read his speeches on this topic in the Lincoln-Douglas debate, they're the type of thing that would make David Duke flush in embarrassment. But what the founders meant, what Jefferson meant in the "all men are created equal" phrase, is that, keep in mind, this was a document saying that the free and independent states of the American colonies are seceding from the British Empire. What they're saying is that the citizens of those states have equal rights to the citizens of Holland or France or Spain or England. All men are created equal. And that's what they meant. And that's, after all, the context is this is a declaration of secession. And we Americans have a right to be free and independent and to rule ourselves, just as you Englishmen do, and just as the Frenchmen do, just as the people of Holland do. That's what Jefferson meant by all men are created equal. After all, the men who signed the Declaration, most of them were slave owners. How could it be conceivable that they would have believed all men are created equal literally, in that context, which they don't. And this was rewritten by Lincoln, and has been repeated over and over again by the nationalists, the advocates of a strong centralized governmental power. Among the contemporaries who are associated with this view are the so-called Straussians in the academic circles, led by their leader, the 90-year-old Harry Jaffa, who has written several books that essentially do nothing but repeat Lincoln's rhetoric about this. And this is where some of the propaganda for the contemporary American wars comes from. Where they think they get the moral authority to wage war on just about anybody in the world. Because after all, if the people of Syria do not have the equal rights that Americans do, it is our duty, they tell us, to launch a military invasion of Syria and force them to be like us. The same is true of Libya and Iraq and Iran and Lebanon and Saudi Arabia, you name it, all the countries of the world that the neoconservatives have on their list of countries that they would like to invade and occupy and rebuild. That's where they think they get their moral authority. And so there are think tanks like the so-called Claremont Institute in California that perpetuates this old myth that Lincoln invented, that not only are all men are created equal, but it is our duty as Americans to see to it that the whole world is created equal in our image. And so it really was a recipe for continuing revolution. And I think that's why so many of the neocons are former Trotskyites. Irving Kristol himself used to brag that he was a Trotskyite in his youth, and I don't think he ever quit being a Trotskyite. And one of the principal tenets of the communistic Trotskyite philosophy was never-ending revolution. The revolution never ends. And so that's where we've got with the sort of the bastardization of the Declaration of Independence, first by Lincoln and then by others. And in my writings, I also quoted H.L. Mencken, who wrote a neat little article, a critique of Lincoln's Gettysburg Address, where he said that we're fighting for the principle that all men are created equal. And of course, he was fighting against the principle of government by consent, not for the principle of government of the people, by the people, or for the people. That's the point H.L. Mencken has made. And there's the legal scholar James Ostrowski wrote an article about this some years ago about Lincoln's, I think it was entitled, "Was President Lincoln's Invasion of the Southern States Constitutional?" It's on the archives in lewrockwell.com. But here's what he said were the necessary prerequisites in Lincoln's view, his argument that secession was not legal. He had to believe, or he had to assert, that the founding fathers, when they adopted the Constitution, believed the following things. Keep in mind, this is what Lincoln would insist Jefferson, Madison, Hamilton, and the rest must have believed when they advanced this Constitution. No state may ever secede from the Union for any reason, one. Two, if any state attempts to secede, the federal government shall invade such a state with sufficient military force to suppress the secession. Three, the federal government may require all states to raise militias to be used to suppress a seceding state or states. Four, After suppressing the secession, the federal government may rule by martial law until such time as the state accepts permanent federal supremacy. That's what happened during Reconstruction. 5, after the secession is suppressed, the federal government may force the states to adopt new state constitutions imposed upon them by federal military authorities, which is what the government did after the Civil War. And 6, the president may, on his own authority and without consulting any other branch of government, suspend the Bill of Rights and the writ of habeas corpus, as Lincoln did during the Civil War. And so you have to believe that the founders thought that all of that was kosher, all of that was okay, to believe that Lincoln's argument that secession was not legitimate. And of course, if the founders had those beliefs, there never would have been a U.S. Constitution. It was barely ratified as it was. Some of the votes in some of the states were just very, very narrow margins. And so we never would have had the adoption of the U.S. Constitution if that was the understanding. Tocqueville himself, I quoted as saying that the states were voluntary, they could leave whenever they want. So did James Madison. Here's one of the things Madison said. A union of the states containing such an ingredient, you talk about secession, seemed to provide for its own destruction. The use of force against the states would look more like a declaration of war than an infliction of punishment, and would probably be considered by the party attacked as dissolution of all previous compacts by which it might be bound. So, and that, of course, is also why the definition of treason in the United States Constitution is in Article 3, Section 3, and it defines treason as only, it uses the word only, levying war upon the states or giving aid and comfort to their enemies. That's it, period. That's the definition of treason. Waging war against the states, plural, meaning the free and independent states. And so, for any reason, don't say unless there's an issue over the collection of tariffs or unless anything. That's all it says. And so, that is Ostrowski's take on this. And that's how the Declaration of Independence was bastardized to make the Declaration seem like it was a nationalist document that supported the oppression of a state that would secede rather than the opposite. And here's Tocqueville, Alexis de Tocqueville's famous book, Democracy in America. He said this, and he's an observer, it's the 1830s, this is published, and one of the most famous books in American political philosophy. He says, the Union was formed by the voluntary agreement of the states, and in uniting together, they have not forfeited their nationality, nor have they been reduced to the condition of one and the same people. If one of the states chooses to withdraw from the compact, it would be difficult to disprove its right of doing so, and the federal government would have no means of maintaining its claims directly either by force or right. That was Tocqueville. John Quincy Adams said the same thing. Of course, all of these men, Calhoun and John Quincy Adams, were unionists. They wanted the Union to succeed, but they did not want it to become a tyranny either. And they wanted it to be voluntary. Here's what John Quincy Adams said in the 1839 speech. That the indissoluble link of union between the people of the several states of this confederated nation is, after all, not in the right but in the heart. If the day should ever come, may heaven avert it, when the affections of the people of these states shall be alienated from each other, when the fraternal spirit shall give way to cold indifference or collision of interests, shall fester into hatred, the bands of political associations will not long hold together parties no longer attracted to the magnetism of conciliated interests and kindly sympathies. And far better will it be for the people of the disunited states to part in friendship from each other than to be held together by constraint. And that was the New England Unionist, John Quincy Adams. So it wasn't just Jefferson and Southerners who were saying these things. It was the Frenchman Tocqueville, it was John Quincy Adams, it was James Madison, who all said these things. Okay. And so as far as, continuing on in the case against secession, at the outbreak of the of what I call the war to prevent sovereign independence, the U.S. Congress proposed several laws that would have outlawed secession. And think about that. This is 1861, and certain members of Congress are proposing new laws to outlaw secession. Now, why would they do that? Well, the obvious answer to the question is that everyone understood that secession was legal. You would not need a new law to outlaw secession if secession was already illegal. And so everyone at the time understood that the Union was voluntary and therefore secession was legal. And of course, the 10th Amendment creates that right. All the powers not given to the central government under Article 1, Section 8, everything else is reserved to the states respectively and to the people. And of course, the people being sovereign, they can leave if they want to. What was the thinking? And of course, that was ended, by the war itself, because the battle over this whole issue over whether or not the states were sovereign or the federal government was sovereign was ended at gunpoint by the war. But it was a long political battle. As I said, Hamilton first created this mythical notion that the states were created by the Union. The Union wasn't created by the states. And then that was repeated by very influential jurists and politicians like Webster and Story. And then Lincoln picked up the same mantle. His basic arguments are the same arguments that were made by Hamilton, by Joseph Story, by Daniel Webster. And they weren't accepted on face value. They were accepted at foot of the gun, essentially, by the war. And so so that's why there was a war, and that certainly is a consequence of the American Civil War, was that the state sovereignty, the right of secession was destroyed along with the right of nullification, and that the people were no longer able to control their own government by threatening secession or nullification, as we discussed last time. And we went on the road to a uniform, consolidated empire at that point. And so that's really the case for secession. Is based, I think, is rooted very solidly in American history. And if you have the right to secede, you have the right to secede. You don't need permission by anyone else. Some people have said that, well, the southern states needed the permission of all the other states. Well, no, they did not. New Englanders never presumed that they would need the permission of the southern states when they held the Hartford Convention of 1814 and discussed seceding from the Union at that point. And no one from the southern states insisted that they had that they should get their permission to leave. They were sovereign after all, and they were sovereign countries. They considered themselves to be sovereign countries, just like Holland or France or Spain was a sovereign country. And I guess that's about what I wanted to say for tonight. I guess I've talked for 40 minutes here. I just put a few readings on the reading list. Maybe we'll devote more time to Q&A if we can for the rest of the time. And that's essentially sort of my overview of the case for secession. And let me see if I have any good comments or questions, and I'll be glad to answer them. Yeah, Cam is talking about, I guess it's a professor of his, don't waste your breath. These people don't want to argue with you. Educate people who are open-minded. Don't argue with people like that. That's been my experience. Well, Ludwig von Mises was certainly a lone wolf. There's a lot of talk about being a lone wolf. If you're a champion of freedom, you're a lone wolf in most institutions of America, it seems like. Let's see. I'm looking for questions here. But what a chat going on here. Unlimited chat. Hit the Q&A. Here's a cue. Are there any truly Jeffersonian style or Southern Confederacy style constitutions or political arrangements in the world today that are actually observed by law? Since you mentioned that, there's a book, Marshall DeRosa, who will be at the Austrian Scholars Conference in Auburn in a few weeks, wrote his doctoral dissertation on the Confederate Constitution, and it's published as a book now. And he's written several books on constitutions. And so if you did a search of Marshall DeRosa, I think you'd find something like that. I assume the Swiss Constitution is very much similar to the Confederate Constitution. Now, the Confederate Constitution was almost identical to the U.S. Constitution. If you go online and get a copy of it, almost identical all the way down the line with a few notable exceptions. Both constitutions allowed slavery to exist. The Confederate Constitution, like the U.S. Constitution, banned the transatlantic slave trade. One difference is the Confederate Constitution allowed individual states to abolish slavery if they wanted to. There's nothing like that in the there was nothing like that in the original U.S. Constitution. The Confederate Constitution eliminated the General Welfare Clause, which has done so much damage to freedom. It also prohibited protectionist tariffs and limited government subsidies to corporations for dredging of harbors only. The only internal improvement subsidies that could be funded by tax dollars was the dredging of harbors and nothing else. And so those are some of the more notable differences, but most everything else is the same. But Switzerland is where I would look. One place for that type of constitution, because Switzerland is famous for being a highly decentralized polity. Livingston says the idea of secession is very much alive today. Just go online and Google secession movements in the world, and you'll find hundreds of them. There's a big long list on the web of this. It's only in America where the empire has for generations has obliterated the very word from the vocabulary. And as Livingston also mentions, that the U.S. government was one of the very last governments in the world to recognize the former Soviet republics as independent states, because they became independent republics through acts of peaceful secession, and they did not want to admit that peaceful secession was a legitimate thing, because who knows, Texas might be next. And we can't have that. And so, yes, only in America is secession sort of a bad word. And they were called a neo-Confederate. And, I still am trying to figure out what that means anyway. Does that mean you're somebody who wants to bring back slavery? Is that what this is about, neo-Confederate? I haven't seen a definition of it. It's just a cuss word in the minds of a lot of people. Where is this being debated? Seriously, the whole Soviet Union did dissolve through the peaceful acts of secession. And as I said, if you go online, you'll find secession movements are everywhere. Well, the whole trend in the 20th century was consolidation. I mean, Livingston mentioned that the old system of European hundreds of city-states, which was very conducive to freedom because it gave citizens many, many escape routes from tyranny, was ended through numerous acts of conquest, of military conquest by governments, and ended up creating just a couple of dozen highly centralized governments. So the whole trend of the world in the whole 20th century was toward centralized governmental bureaucracies, but that wasn't the whole trend of all world history. It was only the 20th century and the late 19th century where we had that trend, and it's been an awful trend. It gave us the Soviet Union. It gave us It gave us Central and Eastern Europe under communism. It gave us the America going from a republic to an empire, a militaristic empire, and all the bureaucracy that we have. And so it's, you know, the fact that there are not hundreds of secession movements today, well, what they actually are, is not really a case against secession. And of course, nowadays, no one is saying we need to secede to bring back slavery or segregation or anything else like that. It's all about freedom. And so that argument is just totally irrelevant. And the whole neo-Confederate slander is totally irrelevant. No one is proposing bringing back Jim Crow laws or anything of that sort. Jessica says, could the federal government be considered an enemy of the states, in which case paying federal taxes would be aiding and abetting the enemy? Well, yeah, it can. It's an enemy and a friend, isn't it? It gives the states tax money, which it takes from them first. And so, I guess you could think that way. Well, Lincoln waged a military invasion of the states. You know, and that was the very definition of treason under the United States Constitution. And it was, I believe it was Daniel Webster before Lincoln who redefined treason in his famous debate with Robert Hayne as essentially being opposition to federal policy. He called treasonous. And that's how Lincoln defined treason during his administration, opposition to him in his administration. But the Constitution defines treason as levying war. Use the words levying war upon the states, period. That's it. It doesn't say giving them a hard time, harassing them, opposing them. It says waging war. And that, of course, is precisely what Lincoln did. Any more questions? The camera wants to know if I read the book Lincoln's Marxists by Brinson and Kennedy. I read parts of it. They sent it to me and I read parts of it. There's also a book called Melting Pot Soldiers. It is true that there were a lot of revolutionaries from the communist revolutions in Europe in 1848 who failed. Those revolutions failed there, who then came to America, and some of them were officers in Lincoln's army. They liked the idea of revolution and trying to take over after the revolution, which they didn't succeed in taking over and imposing their sort of Marxian views, but there were a lot of Marxist ideologues who participated in the revolutions of 1848 in Europe, who then in the 1850s came here to the United States and who were part of Lincoln's army. That's true. But I don't buy the argument that Lincoln himself was some sort of closet Marxist or anything like that. He was a machine politician, basically. So it's sort of a coincidence that, yes, there were Marxists in his army, but I don't think there was any conspiracy or plot of any sort. Let's see, I lost some questions here. Do you think you could be for states' rights and yet anti-secession? Not historically speaking. Historically speaking, Jefferson himself is the one name most associated with states' rights, and of course he believed the states should have a right of secession. So if you call yourself an advocate of states' rights but you're opposed to secession, you're not really an advocate of states' rights. You're an advocate in name only, and but you don't mean the real thing. In my view. Well, Tim wants to know if the citizens can use the 10th Amendment to the state of citizens of the state will no longer comply with the income tax. Well, yeah, they could do that, but of course, as long as the state has enough guns with which to enforce the income tax, it will enforce the income tax. And so the only way to get rid of the income tax would be legally and peacefully and challenging it on constitutional grounds or through policy. Ron Paul has run on a platform to eliminate the income tax. But I think if a state nullified the income tax, the government would use violence to oppose the income tax. Daniel's asking about a book on the colonial America. Well, the emphasis is on liberty and all the various advocates of liberty and what they did in colonial America. It's a good book for that reason. It's not necessarily the best book on everything about colonial America. And I'm not an expert on colonial America myself, but I do know Rothbard's book. I highly recommend it. If you're going to read a book about that period, that's a great one to read. See if there's another Q&A in here. You know, Norway and Sweden stood apart as far as secession goes. Yeah, I'll look at the chat again. Civil Equality Book for Ancient History. I would check out the Liberty Fund book catalog. I think the Liberty Fund book catalog, which I assume is online, has some books on ancient history and from a libertarian perspective. I know Lord Acton, the great British historian of liberty, wrote about liberty in antiquity. So in the Liberty Fund sells a lot of his writings on his books. So I would look into what Lord Acton has written on the subject. And I would look up the Liberty Fund book catalog also. Which I just happened to get a hard copy in the mail last week. Let's see, Bob wants me to comment on the food Nazi issue. Well, you know, I wrote a book with Jim Bennett years ago entitled The Food and Drink Police, America's Nannies, Busybodies, and Petty Tyrants. And we argued in that book that the assault on tobacco was just the beginning, that the same people were going to go after beer, wine, liquor, and fast food next. And we were right, weren't we? You know, that's what they're doing. They are totalitarians, after all, and so we shouldn't fool ourselves. They might call themselves Democrats or Republicans or something else, but they're totalitarian and they want to run every aspect of your life. And that book is out of print now, but I think you can still buy used copies of it around. I should probably write an updated version of it. See if there's any Q&A questions again. Daniel Piano just has a question mark. I can't really answer that one. Any other questions from the audience? Okay, well, if there are no more questions, I guess we can call it an early night. We'll see if the Q&A, question mark. Okay, well, I guess we'll call it an early night then if there are no more questions. And thank you for participating, and I hope you learned something again tonight. And we'll talk about the bad guys next week, the enemies of states' rights, and why they're motivated in the ways they are. And have a good night.